Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Nachhalt-Podcasts vom Nachhaltigkeitsbüro der HU. Heute wieder mit dem neuesten Vortrag aus unserer Ringvorlesungsreihe Der grüne Faden. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören!
This is a truly interdisciplinary topic, and I think, from my understanding, many of you come from different disciplines, and I think this is also a very nice basis for us then to have a nice discussion later about the topic. I'm sure many of you have already heard about the linkages between climate change, environmental changes, and human mobility. And it's also a topic which is quite timely and has received a lot of attention. And this is also how I would like to start my presentation today. I have brought you a number of news reports from the last years where you can see how the media has reported about the topic of environmental migration, environmental displacement. And what you can see here is on one side that it has received quite a bit of attention also from major media outlets, but that often the headlines are rather simplistic ones that are emphasizing the number of people that are potentially going to be displaced because of climate change, the number of people that might potentially migrate, for example, to Europe. And today I would like to show you that the topic is in many ways much more complex than what we see in these media headlines. And there's much more things that we need to take into account, much more aspects that we need to take into account to fully understand what really climate mobility, as I will be referring to it, really means. And I also argue for a more human-centered perspective in this debate, a perspective that takes a closer focus on the needs and capabilities of the humans, including migrants, that are affected by climate change, as I believe this is really something that is urgently needed in the current debates. So for the talk today, I would like to follow the following outline. At the beginning, I would briefly like to talk about the general links between climate change impacts and populations. So to what extent is climate change really of relevance for populations, and where are impacts felt? Then I would like to provide you a brief overview of the topic of climate mobility, that is any form of movement due to climatic events or environmental change processes, and also introduce you to some central concepts in the literature. Before I will then move on to present some stylized findings and estimates also from previous studies. In section four, I will highlight some more complexities of the whole topic, and this is really something that I have already said before. So when we talk about the links between climate, environment, and mobility outcomes, this is truly a very complex topic, and I will highlight here why this is the case and why we often see very diverse forms of mobility if there is an environmental event, and also other responses to environmental change processes. And then I would like to conclude very briefly with some implications and a discussion of the relevance of the whole topic for policy. Starting with some general remarks on the role of climate impacts and populations, I guess it is needless to say, but I've still included it. You all know that the human influence has had a major impact on the climate, and we have seen in the past decades really an unprecedented warming trend that has been unprecedented for the last 2000 years, where the anthropogenic influence is clearly visible. And these impacts are also going to continue to influence our world under most of the scenarios that we have to basically calculate future impacts of climate change. A future warming trend is expected unless there is really an immediate reduction in emissions. And as we have seen now from the COP26, is still a bit of a way to go to really achieve the climate targets that the world has set. These changes in warming, they have really major impacts on the world and our climate system, and also local impacts on the different regions of the world. What is important here is that the world is not uniformly affected by these global changes in the climatic conditions, but different regions are differently affected by the temperature increases we currently observe. I have brought you here three illustrations from the last IPCC report, where you can clearly see that some areas of the world, and it's often areas that already are characterized by quite dire environmental conditions, are the ones to experience the harshest changes in temperatures and then also related hazards. What is also important here is to see that we can really still make a difference globally, also by capping the warming, for example, to 1.5 degrees. So the world we are looking at would be a very different one, depending on what pathway we are going to take in terms of future warming. So each and every degree and deci degree really matters here. In some regions, the impacts of climate change may be so strong that limits to adaptation may be reached, where the risks and losses due to climate impacts may rise to intolerable levels, that is, levels where local populations can no longer sustain their livelihoods or their existences. And this is, of course, the moment then when also mobility becomes very relevant, because in these cases, migrating away from those areas might be the only suitable survival strategy for those people. Depending on which geographical region we look at, climate change can have very, very different impacts on the local level. We here look at, for example, differences in, for example, impacts such as rising sea levels or flooding, heat and drought events, impacts due to wind and erosion, storms and heavy rainfall, and forest fires, such as have seen them in the US in the past years, and also loss of biodiversity. All of these differential impacts can have, in turn, an effect on human systems, and then in turn also affect mobility patterns. And how exactly, we will take a closer look at this in a moment. What I wanted to show you here is that these impacts of climate change, even though we see some differences between regions, they are truly global. So that's really a global issue. And this is also the answer to one of the statements that I've given you. There is no region in the world that will not be affected and is not already affected by climate change and its impacts. And you see that these impacts range from diverse, basically affect differential sectors such as the biological system that is here depicted in green, that is impacts that are highlighted in green in this graph that I've also taken from the previous IPCC report, and also impacts on human systems, which are highlighted here in red. And you see quite a diversity in the impact, and depending on what the impacts are, we see also differential impacts on populations. And this is quite important when it comes to understanding then the links to human mobility, because each and every different effect on different systems can have different implications and ramifications for how people move, migrate, or are forced to leave their homes. I wanted to illustrate that with an example here from Peru that I've taken from research from one of my colleagues, Jonas Bergmann, who has done a lot of work on the linkages between climate change and migration in Peru. He has also prepared an assessment report for IOM on climate change and migration in Peru. And I have taken here two pictures from Peru where you can see that the impacts and consequences of climate change can have very different effects depending on also where you are. So the top picture is from the mountainous regions of Peru. So those of you who are familiar with the country, Peru has a coastline, some plains coastline, and some highlands, and then some rainforest regions. So this is like the three major zones that you can find in Peru. For people who are living in the mountains in Peru, the big challenge in the future will be that they are facing water scarcity, mainly because of the melting of the glaciers. So many of the communities in the mountains in Peru, they retrieve their drinking water and also the water they use for irrigation and agricultural activities. They take it from the flows and streams that come from the glaciers, and these are slowly melting, putting really a high pressure on water security in these areas. At the same time, we see in Peru increased flooding risks in the plains, with some major floods occurring in the past years, where people were forcefully displaced from their homes because there was basically too much water, too much rainfall, and resulting flooding. So here you see that in the same country, we have really this paradox impacts that you have on one side in one area too much water, and the other area in the mountains too little water, highlighting really the diversity of the impacts on populations. Climate impacts are of relevance for various aspects of human systems, for various issues related to our livelihoods. I have here displayed the Sustainable Development Goals to highlight that really climate change can potentially have an impact on many of these goals, and might in fact already today put the achievement of some of these goals at risk. I'm just mentioning a few, for example, risk related to increasing poverty, of course, food security, health, access to clean energy, clean water and sanitation, working conditions, and of course also livelihoods in cities and communities. And this is just a few of them. What is important when we talk about climate impacts on populations is that it's not just natural forces that basically influence populations, but it's always an interplay between socioeconomic processes on one side, which you see here depicted on the right-hand side, and natural forces on the left-hand side that together determine the risk that a household or a community is exposed to or faces. So especially like social and economic processes, they are relevant, for example, in influencing whether households are exposed to hazards, and of course also to what extent they are vulnerable, that is susceptible to the influence of these hazards. And also when we talk about whether households migrate once they are facing environmental hazards, this question is of course very important. To what extent are they exposed and also vulnerable to these influences, and to what extent does that force them to leave their homes or not? Which brings me to the main topic of today, the topic of climate mobility. I would like to start with a brief overview of this concept. So climate mobility we understand as any form of mobility that occurs as a direct or indirect consequence of climatic or environmental more broadly influences. This can be both sudden onset or gradual processes. So that sudden onset is like a disaster that occurs, whereas gradual processes are slow onset events that unfold their devastating potential over a longer time horizon. What is important here, and this is answering to one of the other statements that I've given you before, moving away from inhabitable and dangerous regions has really been a survival strategy at all times of human history. So we find analogues to climate mobilities that we see today in many parts of our human history. It's really an anthropological constant, if you want. Here to the right, I've brought you a picture from the so-called US Dust Bowl migration. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this. So as I said, often environmental impacts can be one of the reasons why people decide to move away from an affected area. But in most cases, what we also see in empirical studies is that it's really a mixture of different causes, which are often very closely related to each other. And we will talk about this also in a moment. I wanted to give you a brief overview of how this concept of climate mobility has evolved over time. Here I brought you a table from a historical overview of this. I've given you the site, the source at the bottom, where you see how this concept of environmentally induced mobility or migration has evolved over time. What is interesting is that already early migration theories, such as by Ravenstein, for example, have emphasized the role of the environment for migration processes. And then this idea that environmental change processes can influence migration has gotten a little bit lost and only came back into the literature in the middle of the last century, mainly against the background as the environment is being seen as a minor reason for migration. You also see this here in the terminology used. At the beginning, they were very much referring to environmentally induced migration as a primitive form of migration. And only then in the 1980s and 1990s, this has gradually started to change. When we were more and more facing the consequences of climate change, of course, where we now start to really shift more our focus on the issue of environmental change and human mobilities. What we see is that already today in many regions of the world, changes in environmental and climatic conditions are closely linked to migration dynamics and different other forms of human mobility. I have brought you here a figure from one of our recent publications where we looked into the relationship between different processes of environmental changes at the bottom part. And then at the top part, this is the trend lines, different mobility outcomes, where we could show that in different parts of the world, we see relationships between the two factors, the two variables. But what we also saw is that the strength and the direction of the relationship very much depended on local conditions and, of course, also the type and intensity of the experienced environmental influences. So there is truly no automatism at play when we talk about the linkages between environmental change and mobility. Not everyone also who is affected will migrate, and I will show you more about this later. Before that, I would like to briefly highlight that when I talk about mobility and climate mobility, then I basically talk about very diverse forms of mobility that mobility can take. And actually, there is not one form of climate mobility at the end of the day. Mobility can be temporary or permanent. It can be short distance or long distance. It can be within a country, that is internal migration, or international. It can be circular or linear, and different other forms. So we have really a multiplicity of different forms that mobilities can take. And this puts also us researchers, as well as policymakers and practitioners, it gives us many challenges, of course, when it comes to measuring mobility outcomes, when it comes to predicting mobility in the future and so on. Important distinction is the one between migration, displacement, and then also relocation. So when I talk about climate mobility, I'm referring basically to different forms of movements that includes all of these three mentioned ones here. When we talk about migration, we speak of either temporarily or permanently resettlements, that is spatial movements, that can be either forced or voluntarily. So with migration, it doesn't make really a difference if people were initially forced to move or decided by themselves voluntarily. What is important is that they relocate to a different location. When we talk about displacement, on the other hand, we have basically only forced movements in mind that result from a specific hazard. Typically, these are rather short-term moves, short-distance moves, where also people tend to return back to their home locations in many cases. So this distinction between migration and displacement is quite common because it's often also confused then in the public debates. Of course, displacement can result or can be migration if people stay in the destination areas where they migrated to. Relocation, which I will not touch upon so much here, that refers to any planned or assisted form of mobility. For example, if a hazard if a hazard might occur, then governments might decide to relocate population. And this also does not necessarily have to be voluntarily. So that's also quite interesting. There's interesting research about this as well, that of course, some population might not want to be relocated, and the success of such relocation programs very much depends on involving the communities that are to be relocated and taking them on board to really basically have also their decision power in this. We typically distinguish or describe climate mobility along a continuum, where on one side you have more forced forms of displacement that result from unforeseen rapid events where people have very low levels of control and are, of course, very vulnerable. And on the other side, more voluntary forms of migration where people have greater control over the process and often where the basically migration is used rather as a preventive strategy, as a potentially adaptive strategy to environmental change processes, and not so much as a measure of last resort. So this is also why you see the voluntary migration rather as a response to more long-term, gradually unfolding environmental threats, whereas forced displacement is more common with rapid onset events and catastrophes. The decision to migrate or to move is at the end an outcome of complex interactions between both contextual influences and individual factors that shape whether a household or an individual decides or can afford to leave the home. And the environment, climatic factors are just one of many factors that play a role here. So it's really an interplay of many different aspects and factors that shape mobility outcomes. And this is also what makes this field for research quite interesting, but also quite challenging, because for us, basically identifying in which areas, which of these factors is most relevant, and then using it, for example, to predict out-migration from an area in the future, that is not so easy because these factors can very strongly vary depending on what respective context we look at. Climate change, to make it even more complex, climate change can not only affect mobility directly, for example, by representing an immediate threat for populations or undermining immediately the livelihoods of populations, but it can also affect mobility outcomes indirectly. So, for example, by undermining economic or political or social systems that then in turn lead, for example, to increased migration. So I've given you a few examples here. For example, a depletion of resources that can gradually lead to increased pressures on populations, increased livelihood risks, and then forces people to move out. But the actual climate signal might already might not be so strongly visible in this case. Or imagine a rapid onset disaster event that then has ramifications for local societies, which then in turn leads to greater mobility from that area. We would still have an impact here from the environmental side, but it is an indirect one. When it comes to our scientific knowledge from our scientific literature, then tentatively we have a better knowledge about the direct impacts of environmental events and also climatic changes in areas on migration compared to the indirect ones, simply because there's such an enormous complexity involved in understanding how these different potential channels can influence mobility outcomes in different contexts. I brought you one example here with conflicts to also once more make the point that climatic changes alone are really the only reason for migration, but that they can indirectly be related or also exacerbate the consequences of other drivers. So conflict is an interesting mechanism or channel to look at. And I'm sure many of you have heard about discussions about how climate change can fuel conflicts, which then in turn can result in migration. And there is now literature that shows really that there is linkages, but again, not in all cases, not in all contexts, and which is also partly related to the complexity of the different relationships and channels of influence. So I've depicted here one possible chain of influence that you could think of how conflict could come into play when we talk about this climate, environment, and migration nexus. For example, we could see in some area a drought resulting in increased food insecurity that if it's met with low adaptive capacity, might lead to a conflict over scarce resources, which then may trigger out-migration from an area. At the same time, here, of course, the question is then, what is the cause now for the migration? Is it really the conflict, let's say the immediate cause, or is it the climate as the underlying cause of the conflict? And if you look deeper into this, it could also be that climate has an effect. The links could also be different in a way that climate affects first migration, for example, by undermining, let's say, the livelihood of people. People have to move out, which can then lead to, for example, to conflict in destination areas. And what we see in some parts of the world where, for example, pastoralists are changing their herding behaviors and their herding routes, and increasingly interfere with farmers' lands, And this leads then to a conflict in those areas that are either on the way of the herders or the destinations of the nomads. So you see that conflict. There's multiple linkages through which conflicts come into play here, and definitely a relevant source. But again, just to remind you of that, the underlying socioeconomic and sociopolitical conditions in an area play a very, very important role here. If a conflict, for example, breaks up, if deterioration of resources lead to conflict and so on, so there's more to the picture than just the simple environmental factor behind it. I wanted to give you a few stylized findings and estimates from the literature so that you can get a better understanding also about the extent of environmental migration worldwide and what we're actually referring to or what patterns we observe empirically. So here's a summary of some key findings from the literature. So when we talk about environmental mobility, then we primarily talk about internal or regional mobility. So in the rarest cases, people really migrate across the borders of their country. So this was one of the other statements that I've given you. And this is also one of the main misperceptions, maybe when we talk about climate change and migration, that many people have this image in mind that large waves of refugees might be coming in the future. But in fact, this is rather an issue for the regions of origin of the people, because most of the people remain within their regions of origin or within the borders of their country. Many migrants move from rural areas to urban centers. So you might be aware that many cities have seen really a rapid urban growth in the past years, which of course puts a lot of pressure on the urban environments and also, for example, urban labor markets and so on, infrastructures and so on. Migration typically is a household decision. So it's not a decision that is typically made by an individual, but often made by an entire household. And what we often see as a pattern is that then only few members of households migrate, especially when it comes to more gradual impacts of environmental changes. Then one can see that gradually people start out-migrating in a form that households start sending few of their members, for example, to close by cities or urban centers in the countries. Typically, it's younger unmarried individuals without property and without obligations that are the ones to migrate. It's typically, in many parts of the world, we see that it's more men who are changing their migration behavior as a response to environmental hazards or environmental changes. But this is not universal. So there's also some very interesting research from the past years that shows that this is really very strongly influenced by cultural patterns, characteristics of the areas where people are migrating from. I've recently heard a presentation from Nepal where the speaker was referring to changes in marriage migration of women in Nepal. So we see also, depending on the local context, differences in these patterns. What is important in all cases is social networks. So we see a very important role of social networks in destination and origin regions that really play a key role in shaping mobility outcomes and migration processes. An important pull factor for migrants is, of course, alternative income earning opportunities. So households, by sending migrants, for example, to other areas, attempt in some cases, if it's not displacement, if it's proper migration, in some cases to diversify the income sources, to have other income sources in addition to, for example, agricultural income, that then allows them also to better cope with shocks in the future. And just to reiterate that, as I said before, truly migration can only be understood against the background of local socioeconomic, cultural, and political context that very much shape the outcomes of mobility and also the risks and challenges faced for migrants and their families. Here I have brought a figure from the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, which shows the number of new displacements, both due to conflict and environmental hazards in the year 2020. The conflict displacements in these pie charts are highlighted in orange. The ones due to environmental causes are the ones in blue. And what you can see maybe from here is that the largest share of displacements due to environmental hazards is actually not in Africa, but in Asia. So we really see that most people who get displaced every year is in South Asia or Southeast Asia. So here we see the main impact on displacement. That also holds when you correct for the larger population sizes in these areas. What you also see is that while we see that in some regions conflict are really the main driver of displacement, and we see that overall globally it is still the majority of displacements are due to environmental hazards. So the statement that I gave you before, that conflicts and war are responsible for 3 times as many displacements as environmental causes, it's exactly the opposite. So on average over the past years, it's usually 3 times as many people that are displaced due to environmental hazards compared to conflicts and war, which is shocking, both for the sheer number of people that are displaced, but also for given the fact that often these people do not really have a strong reflection, for example, in our public debates, and are not very visible in our public debates if you compare it, for example, to displacement due to conflict and wars that are, of course, also horrible. Here I've given you a breakdown of the number of displacements in 2020, where you can see to the right the displacements that occurred due to environmental hazards, split up in geophysical and weather-related hazards. So weather-related, the ones that are more closely affected by climatic changes. And here, if you move a little bit more to the right, you can see that floods and storms are really the two primary causes of displacements that we see among the environmental hazards. So these two, depending on the year, they change, usually can change the position. So when you voted floods, when we talked about the statements before, and you thought that floods were the primary reason, so they are definitely one of the primary reasons. So you were also right here. So they account for about storms and floods almost account for the entire share of weather-related displacements that we see globally. The question here is, of course, and we can discuss this in greater detail later, is of course, how reliable is the data? So you see, for example, here at the bottom part, you see that the IDMC claims, that only 32,000 people or displacements were recorded due to droughts, which is certainly a very, very low number. And I would say this is not necessarily because droughts do not displace people, but because it's harder for the IDMC to really capture those displacements, because they are not related necessarily to an immediate event to which you can connect the displacements that occur to. But they are more gradual processes that can also unfold over years and also lead to migration displacement then over a longer time horizon. Generally, when we are not talking about displacement, but about migration, so basically people moving to other regions or other countries, the picture gets a little bit more difficult. Here I have brought you a map showing the annual net migration rates averaged over 2015 to 2020, and that is measuring per 1,000 people. So the general challenge is that whereas with displacements you can clearly link, or often in many cases you have a clearer link between an environmental event and a mobility outcome, it is not so clear when you look at the general migration patterns of people, especially not when you look at singular countries, for example. Why is that? Because it's hard to determine what the underlying reasons were, why people were migrating away from a region or a country. Typically what we do is then we look basically at the entire world and look at whether overall on average we see relationships between changes in livelihoods, in environmental conditions, climatic conditions, and whether these affect over time mobility patterns. But it's very hard to basically pin this down for a single country. One really can just look at this in a larger aggregate. Nevertheless, there has been, despite these difficulties, some attempts been made in the literature to basically pin down the number of environmental migrants, climate migrants, with more accurate estimates. I've given you here an overview of different estimates that have been made in the past years, that typically where you have predictions until the year 2050, that is the last column here to the right, ranging in a range of several hundred million people that are expected to be displaced due to environmental change processes. Here, I would just like to say that all of these numbers, they rest on a lot of assumptions. So one has to be extremely careful when basically taking these numbers. They should not be taken at face value, but just giving an indication of where we might move in terms of migration in the future, but they also involve a substantive uncertainty. One projection that has received quite a bit of attention in the past years is the projections done by the Groundswell report. That is a report that was issued by the World Bank, but now there is a second report out, a second part out, that basically extended the first one. This report that has mainly focused on internal migration, they also came to the conclusion that as many as 260 million people could be forced to move within their own countries due to slow onset, mainly climate change impacts by 2050. So what I would like you to take away from that is that on one side, we have a lot of uncertainty when it comes to these projections of future impacts on migration. But at the same time, we see that this topic is quite of relevance for a substantive number of people globally. So it's not a minor issue at the end of the day. And again, as I said before, it's less of a challenge for the wealthy countries, but rather really for a challenge of the country, for the countries where the people are migrating, especially for both communities from where they migrate away, but also for areas where they might be going to. So that is really something where policy measures are needed to prepare those destination areas to accommodate and also integrate migrants in the future. And before coming to an end, I would just briefly like to once more highlight the diversity and complexity that is in this climate-related, written immobility topic that is inherent in this topic. Here again, I have brought you an example from Peru, from the research of my colleague, where you can see that basically migration and mobility more generally, they are used for also different causes depending on the different livelihood conditions people face. Again, there is not one form of climate mobility that we observe. We see, but still we see that multiple groups and communities are using migration as a livelihood and potentially also as an adaptation strategy, ranging from fishermen at the coastline to farmers in the highlands to farmers in the rainforest. But as you see, with very different and diverse forms, in very different and diverse forms. Migration is not always a linear process, and this is also true for climate mobility. Often what we see is that people show some circular migration patterns, that is, that they, for example, migrate from a region A to a region B and then return to region A. What we also see is that they then continue to region C and return to region B and so on. So there is a lot of movement going on. This is also for you to basically make you aware that this is not just an origin sending to receiving area, but it's more complex. There's really different migration trajectories. People take different routes and so on. All of these processes are also closely embedded in generally sustainable development and processes and generally other population dynamics that are closely linked to these mobility outcomes that we observe. What I also want to highlight here is when we talk about research on climate change and migration mobilities, then we're not only interested in how environmental hazards affect out-migration from a region A, but we're really interested in the entire spectrum of the mobility process and up to the prospective destination areas. So what we see, for example, today is that many migrants are moving into cities where they are then facing other environmental challenges, maybe different ones that they have seen in their previous regions of origin, but that can still be very devastating for their livelihoods. For example, we see that flooding is a major issue in many cities, for example, in Africa, where people who are forced to live in informal settlements are the ones that are primarily affected. And this can, in the worst case, also lead to something what we call secondary displaced. People who were once displaced are displaced again and potentially again. What is also important is, when we're talking about this topic, is that, of course, not everyone who is affected by an environmental change or hazard migrates. There is really a large number of people in communities that stay in place. And this has to do with a number of other factors, ranging from the question how severely affected households are. So we discussed about this at the very beginning, that when you remember about this diagram that I've shown you from the IPCC, that basically risk is a combination of exposure to a hazard and vulnerability. So the question is, how severely affected are groups of populations? Do they have potentially any other ways to adapt to changes in situ, so locally? And also the questions, are there sufficient resources to migrate for them? So this is another very hot topic currently in the literature. We see that that some groups are simply not able to migrate or to leave affected areas, hazardous areas, because they are lacking sufficient resources to, for example, build up a life elsewhere. And these populations who we refer to as trapped populations, so trapped because they cannot escape the environmental hazard, they are, of course, characterized by a very, very high vulnerability and face very dire conditions and deserve also special attention. In some cases, and I just wanted to highlight that here as well, people also don't have a motivation in many cases to move. Often in migration research, one has this very deterministic perception that if something happens, if there's a hazard occurring, then people will automatically start migrating. But this is completely disconnected from the actual reality that many people are facing, where they, of course, also have strong incentives to stay and to remain in their home regions and also in a region where they have social networks and a cultural heritage. So, as I said before, differences in vulnerability and exposure, they play an important role when we look at mobility outcomes as a result of environmental stresses. And here, non-climatic factors that result from non-climatic factors play an important role. This can be inequalities, that can be poverty, that can be limited access to health services in an area. They can all shape whether a population is vulnerable or not, and can affect basically how severely the population is affected by a climatic impact. Often it is the poorest ones that are worst affected. This you see here at the bottom part of this graph, that have the highest levels of vulnerability. And those are also the ones that are most easily getting trapped confronted with a hazardous situation. We have actually done a number of studies now where we could show really that it is mainly populations with a middle income, so middle income groups, not the very wealthy ones in a community, not the very poor ones, but more the ones in the middle income range, middle wealth range, that then respond to environmental hazards by changing their migration behaviors. Just to summarize this here, so there's multiple responses how households and communities can respond to environmental stresses. There is no determinism in play when it comes to climate change, environmental change, and mobility outcomes. So people can either migrate on one side, then the question is, did they migrate because it was a voluntary decision, or did they move because they were forcefully displaced? Or they can, and this is often the larger group, remain in place, immobile. Then the question is, haven't they been affected? Do they have no incentives to migrate, or a strong incentive to remain in their origin areas? Or are they actually trapped populations that have no abilities, no capabilities to leave the affected areas? And you see, it's really a very broad set of different groups, and that opens up the complexity of this whole topic, that also requires holistic policy responses that basically address all of these different groups in an appropriate way. And this is the last point I want to talk about, implications and policy measures. So complexity requires holistic, interconnected, and, as I've said, human-centered interventions and policies that address different levels. So how can we basically help people who are affected by climate change? How can we help migrants displaced who are forced to leave their homes? Initially, the first step is, of course, by investing in climate protection and avoiding in the first place that future climate impacts occur. So that is all what falls under the umbrella of mitigation. So that's, of course, very important. We should not forget that with this, we have a very strong impact on basically the future and the livelihoods of people in many parts of the world. At the same time, it's also important to invest into improving the abilities to adapt to changing climatic and environmental conditions in different parts of the world. So adaptation, especially since we know that many of the climate impacts that have already begun to affect us, they are going to get worse in the next years and decades, irrespective of how we change our consumption, our production behavior, simply because we have already emitted so much emissions that basically the climate will still change for the next couple of decades. So adaptation is really key, and support of communities is really important here. Household vulnerability, working on vulnerability to limit the harmful effects of climate change is another aspect. Then if it really comes to migration, it's important that we create legal and political frameworks that allow us both to protect migrants, but also those populations that remain immobile. And finally, it is important to, in this whole discussion, to not forget the destination areas, to prepare them to allow for smooth integration of migrants. And this preparation is, of course, not only addressing the destination areas, but can already start in the origin areas of migrants, for example, by enhancing skill sets of potential migrants in the future, by giving them education and training that allows them then to successfully integrate into labor markets in the prospective urban destinations where they might migrate into the future. So before coming to an end, just here have summarized some of the points that I've just mentioned that I think are quite important related to improving adaptive capacities and resilience. And I would invite you to read those after the presentation, once you have received the slides. I've also given you here a summary of achievements in terms of legal and political recognition of the topic climate migration displacement, but also highlighting that there's still a long way to go to fill up basically the gaps in legal and policy frameworks to truly protect environmental and climate migrants worldwide. And finally, I have given you a link here to one of our recent briefs where we looked at some of these links between environmental and climate systems, migration and urbanization processes, which I personally think is very important. And I would also here invite you to take a closer look at it, also to see basically how this how these different relationships come into play and why they matter. Just as a last slide with content, why it matters, I have brought you here. Cities are really strongly affected by migration moves, internal migration moves primarily, that we see all over the world. We have seen really an incredible population growth in many urban areas, And this is expected to continue in the next years and decades to come. And I've brought you here a graph that was prepared by the Financial Times based on UN population prospect data, where they have shown for the different world regions how cities are expected to grow, and the size of the bubbles is indicating the current size of the cities. So you see that we have already like cities that host quite a few million people, and those cities, and especially in Africa, expected to grow substantially in the period up to the next 10 years, 15 years, so from 2018 to 35. Some of these cities are expected to double in size, to more than double in size in the next 10 to 15 years. Cities like Abuja, Dar es Salaam, or Kampala, so cities that already today have several million inhabitants. And you can only imagine what that meant, what that means for a city to basically grow so rapidly in size. You can imagine Berlin, what happened if it were to grow suddenly from its a bit more than 3 million inhabitants to double the size. So that has really major implications for cities, and there's an urgent need to prepare and make investments into infrastructure and also inclusive efforts that allow also the people who will arrive in the future to find a good life there. And with this, I would like to end with some last take-home messages, just to wrap up. As I said, climate mobility is not a new phenomenon, but something that has been around throughout human history. It is a highly complex and nonlinear phenomena. It has multiple causes and is highly context dependent. The climate environment can influence mobility both directly and indirectly. Migration itself is only one of several potential adaptation strategies households can use. Mobility usually occurs within national boundaries, so we see in rare cases that people are moving beyond those. And finally, just to remind ourselves, migrants and displaced are a highly vulnerable group and in need of special protection. So we need to really take a closer look at the people who are affected by climate change, and of course also consider those people who stay behind or in the worst case and cannot move away from affected areas. And now with this, I really stop, and I thank you very much for your attention.